I invite you to open your Bible to Joshua chapter 4. Joshua chapter 4. When I look at a message this morning, I'm calling Monuments. Tomorrow, of course, is the day that we observe Memorial Day. And Memorial Day was, as you may know, originally known as Decoration Day. It was first observed shortly after the conclusion of the Civil War. And it was a day that was set aside to place flowers and other decorations on the graves of those who had given their lives in defense of their country. Memorial Day became a federal holiday in 1971. It's actually not all that long ago that it became a federal holiday, but it is a day set aside specifically to honor the men and women who have served in the U.S. Armed Forces, and particularly those who have given their lives in defense of the nation. And it's a day that still many, many people will participate in a parade, a service of some sort, will go to a cemetery to honor the memories of those who paid the ultimate sacrifice. And of course, there are famous memorials and monuments all around the world, not just in the United States, though we certainly have many very famous ones in the United States. And as I was preparing this message and thinking about this message, I was thinking about what is the purpose of a monument? What is the purpose of a memorial? And as I thought about that and looked around a little bit, I came across this statement from the War Memorials Trust, which is actually an organization in the United Kingdom, but this statement I think is very appropriate. They say memorials are important because they act as historical touchstones. They link the past to the present and enable people to remember and respect the sacrifice of those who died, fought, participated, or were affected by conflicts. Memorials can be an important source of information for young people in understanding the sacrifices made by past generations. And I would agree wholeheartedly with that statement. Memorials and monuments, of course, they can take a variety of forms. There are some that are incredible architectural accomplishments. They're very large, they are very elaborate, and there are others that are quite simple. But all of them serve the purpose of reminding those who see them of an individual or a group of individuals who did something at some point in the past. And if you've been to a monument or a memorial, regardless of whether it's one that's world famous or one that's significant, perhaps only to you and your family, you have experienced what it is like to stand before a memorial or a monument and ponder what it means, what its significance is. If you've ever visited the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., I would dare say it's impossible to stand at that monument and look at that incredibly large figure of Abraham Lincoln as he gazes forward and not contemplate what it must have been like to be the President of the United States when the country was literally torn in half, when brother was literally fighting brother. It's very difficult to stand there and look to the side wall and read the words of the Gettysburg Address and not think about the thousands of lives that were lost in just a few days. And remember, to borrow Lincoln's words, those honored dead who gave their lives in defense of their country. And while you're there at the Lincoln Memorial, you can go to the top step, if you're looking Lincoln almost straight in the eye, and turn and look at your feet, you'll see a small plaque that indicates where Martin Luther King Jr. stood when he gave his I Have a Dream speech. And then if you turn and look out over the National Mall, it's not difficult to imagine that space filled with thousands of people who had gathered together solely for the purpose of demonstrating that no one should be judged solely on the color of their skin. Or perhaps if you've been to New York City and you've gone to the Statue of Liberty, you have to approach it by boat. It's the only way to get there. It doesn't take much of an imagination to consider what it must have been like for the hundreds of thousands of immigrants to the United States who braved the passage across the ocean to finally see that statue and all that that statue embodied and represented, their hopes for the future, the sacrifices that they had made to come to this country. If you go from there over to Ellis Island, into the building where all of those immigrants were processed, if you're like me at all, you'll wonder what it must have been like to be packed into that building, knowing that there was a few people you were going to talk to and they were going to decide if you get to come into the country or not. To think of everything that you had gone through to get to that point and wonder, is this as close as I'll get or will I get to go in? Of course, if you're at Liberty Island or Ellis Island and then you return to Battery Park at the end of Manhattan, you walk just a couple blocks and you'll see the 9/11 Memorial. And if you're at the 9/11 Memorial, to stand at the edge of those bronze walls surrounding what was the footprint of the World Trade Center towers, and to see those thousands of names etched into the walls, and to see the waterfalls that have been installed on those very simple monuments that quite intentionally cause you to think of something falling downward. And to see that water coming down around those four sides of those two squares and then going down further into a center where you can't see the bottom. And you look up and you're surrounded by skyscrapers. And now, of course, you can see Freedom Tower right there, this humongous, gleaming building. But it doesn't take any imagination, especially if you were watching television on September 11th, 2001, and saw that airplane fly into the World Trade Center, to vividly recall that explosion, and minutes later, that building crumbling to the ground, and the thousands of lives that were lost. There are many other memorials and monuments, of course, that we could recall together this morning. Many of them are deeply moving. If you're ever in Washington, D.C., and you go to the National Holocaust Museum, I guarantee you, you will not leave unaffected. Or similarly, if you go to Hawaii, and visit the USS Arizona. I've not had the opportunity to do that, but everyone that I know who has been there has said that it is a very moving experience. Or you go up to Montana and the Little Bighorn National Battlefield Monument and see the plain markers scattered around the prairie where each person died. Or the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C., with name after name after name. All of these monuments, all of these memorials serve the purpose of causing those who see them to reflect on what happened. To reflect on the conflict, to reflect on the sacrifice, to reflect on the issue, but mostly to reflect on the sacrifice. And they are, as the War Memorial Trust said, they are touchstones. They cause even those who were not there or even alive at the time that the conflict took place to ponder what happened. And if perhaps someone encounters a memorial or a monument and they don't already know what happened, it ponders them to ask, what is this for? What does this commemorate? What event is remembered through this monument? And the idea of a monument or a memorial is not new. In fact, we see it in the Old Testament. And in Joshua chapter 4, we have God instructing the Israelites to make a memorial or to make a monument. And this is one of several occasions in the Old Testament where God does this. But this morning I want to look specifically at this instruction that God gives to the Israelite people in Joshua chapter 4. And from that, I'm going to extrapolate just a little bit and reflect on the importance of monuments for today. But first thing I want to do, I want to read Joshua chapter 4 in its entirety. But before I do that, just a brief bit of background. If we were to go back into Joshua chapter 3, say beginning in verse 13, we have God giving instruction to the Israelite people for how they're going to cross the Jordan River. And it says in verse 13, when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the ark of the Lord of all the earth, the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from flowing, and the waters coming down from above shall stand in one heap. So God gives them this instruction. There's this large river, rapidly flowing river, and it's even overflowing its banks, we see from the text. This is the time of the year where the river was well beyond its normal borders. And they approach the river, they're stuck, humanly speaking. They don't know how they're going to get across that river. And God, through Joshua, says, well, here's what you're going to do. The moment the priest's foot touches the water will dry up. Now, of course, they had to obey. They had to do what God said, because he doesn't say, just as you approach the bank, the water will dry up, and then you can step in. They have to step in before the water stops. But he says, the moment their foot touches the water. So, again, look in verse 1, chapter 4. I'm going to read this chapter in its entirety. It says, when all the nation had finished passing over the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, take 12 men from the people, from each tribe of man, and command them, saying, take 12 stones from here out of the midst of the Jordan, from the very place where the priest's feet stood firmly, and bring them over with you and lay them down in the place where you lodge tonight. Then Joshua called the 12 men from the people of Israel, whom he had appointed, a man from each tribe. And Joshua said to them, pass on before the ark of the Lord your God into the midst of the Jordan, and take up each of you a stone upon his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of the people of Israel, that this may be a sign among you. When your children ask in time to come, what do these stones mean to you? Then you shall tell them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord. When it passed over the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. So these stones shall be to the people of Israel a memorial forever. And the people of Israel did just as Joshua commanded, and they took up 12 stones out of the midst of the Jordan, according to the number of the tribes of the people of Israel, just as the Lord told Joshua. And they carried them over with them to the place where they lodged and laid them down there. And Joshua set up 12 stones in the midst of the Jordan, in the place where the feet of the priest bearing the Ark of the Covenant had stood. And they're there to this day. For the priest bearing the Ark stood in the midst of the Jordan until everything was finished that the Lord commanded Joshua to tell the people, according to all that Moses had commanded Joshua. The people passed over in haste, and when all the people had finished passing over, the Ark of the Lord and the priest passed over before the people. The sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh passed over, armed before the people of Israel, as Moses had told them. About 40,000 ready for war passed over before the Lord for battle to the plains of Jericho. On that day, the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they stood in awe of him, just as they had stood in awe of Moses all the days of his life. And the Lord said to Joshua, command the priests bearing the Ark of Testimony to come up out of the Jordan. So Joshua commanded the priests, come up out of the Jordan. And when the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came up from the midst of the Jordan, and the soles of the priests' feet were lifted up on dry ground, the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and overflowed all its banks as before. The people came up out of the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and they encamped at Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. And those 12 stones, which they took out of the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal. And he said to the people of Israel, when your children ask your fathers in times to come, what do these stones mean? Then you shall let your children know, Israel passed over this Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan for you until you passed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up for us until we passed over, so that all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, that you may fear the Lord your God forever. There's several things I want us to note about this passage. First is that God did an awesome thing. God did an awesome thing. And I don't mean awesome in the way that it's so casually used today in contemporary vernacular, because nowadays awesome is used to apply to almost anything, from a hamburger to a touchdown catch, and many things in between. But the word awesome means literally awe-inspiring. It means something that cannot be explained through any other means other than supernatural accomplishment. And here, God has done an awesome thing. It says that the moment the foot of the priest touched the water, that the water rose up in a heap very far away. That's what it says in verse 16. In the city of Adam, some of the scholars of the Old Testament have debated over where this city of Adam is located. This is verse 16 of chapter 3, by the way, sorry. But it says, the city of Adam beside Zarethan. There's some debate over where the city of Adam is located. And there's not any definitive agreement, but there seems to be two primary locations that are speculated upon. One is 17 miles away, the other is 30 miles away. Either way, it's well upstream. That the water, the moment the priest's feet touched the water, 17, 30 miles away, the water stopped and it just piled up in a heap. I can't imagine what that would have looked like, but it was probably pretty cool. This huge wall of water that just piled up instantly. And this is not a little stream either. As we saw here in this passage, it said that after they came out of the stream, that the river once again overflowed its banks. Right? So this is not a little stream. This is not a creek. But this is a flowing river. Okay? And the text indicates that it dried up and they crossed over on dry ground. And the water didn't disappear. It didn't just evaporate. It didn't just separate this little four-foot pathway for them to walk through. Well upstream, the water stopped and piled up. God did an awesome thing, right? There's no other explanation for it other than that God did it, which, by the way, is no small part of the point. Because if you look at the end of chapter 4, rather, it says, what? It says that he dried up the river, just like he dried up the Red Sea. Why? Verse 24. So that all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, that you may fear the Lord your God forever. Notice what it does not say. It does not say, build this monument so that when your children ask, you can say, the Lord dried up the water, and we walked across because there was no other way to do it. God could have got them across that river in any number of ways. But he chose to do it in a miraculous and awesome, supernatural manner. And then he tells the people to build this monument so that it would trigger their remembrance in the future of what he had done. That's the second thing to note here. Not only did God do an awesome thing, but he wanted the people of Israel to remember what he had done. He wanted them to remember what he had done for their own benefit, and he wanted them to teach it to subsequent generations. He commands Joshua to have 12 men bring 12 stones taken from the midst of the river, carried over and stacked together to make a memorial or a monument, so that, it says several times in this passage, when your children ask in times to come, what's up with that pile of rocks? You then can say, let me tell you about that pile of rocks. God did a pretty incredible thing one time. When I was your age, we've all heard somebody say that, right? But instead of saying, when I was your age, I walked uphill to school both ways. Instead, they said, when I was your age, this river one time was overflowing its banks, and we had to get from one side to the other, And God stopped the water way upstream somewhere. And all of a sudden, it was dry ground. And all of us walked across. This is no, you know, small family gathering, right? This is the entire nation of Israel. We walked across on dry ground. And these stones that are piled up right here, they used to be in the middle of that river. And they were carried over and they were put up by Joshua so that we would remember what God had done. What grandchild would not want to hear their grandfather tell that story, right? So God says, build this monument so that you will be prompted to tell future generations about what I did. And they were to be told exactly what God did, and they were to be told so that they would recognize, as we see in verse 24, that God is mighty, that God is awesome, that God does things that cannot be humanly explained. Now, I'm guessing, if you're at all like me, you're reading this and you're thinking, I'm pretty sure I wouldn't have forgot that. I probably would have told my grandchildren that anyway. It's easy for us now to look back and think that. But the reality is, the human mind is far too prone to forget the awesome works of God. We see miraculous works of God every day. Someone once said, I don't remember who it was, but someone once said, if I only saw one sunrise in my life, I would never be able to stop talking about it. But because we see the sunrise every day, yeah, that's pretty. Nice sunrise this morning. It begins to lose its wonder. And even when something as incredible as this takes place, we're still prone to forget. Romans 1, by the way, tells us that God's handiwork is on display in creation and that therefore no human being is without excuse. Simply because looking at the world around us, contrary to what scientists may like to claim, cannot be explained away through any means other than the awesome works of God. But those of us who are children of God, we should be overflowing with accounts of what God has done in our lives. We should be constantly proclaiming the glory and the wonder and the magnificence of God. The greatest miracle, of course, that ever took place is one of which every child of God is a beneficiary. And that is that God loved the world enough to send his son to the earth. That God himself took on human flesh, was born as a human infant, lived a perfect life, died a cruel death to pay a penalty that we deserve to pay and never could, was buried, rose again the third day, and lives today and is seated at the right hand of God. It's because of his indescribable love for us and the awesome gift which he gave us that we have the hope of eternity. That we do not fear death, that we know that we will spend eternity in the presence of God. And see, if you are here in this church, in this sanctuary, with any regularity, hopefully you've noticed by now that something like that very quick synopsis of the gospel I just gave you seems to come up a lot. And it should. We must never, ever, ever get tired of telling the wonderful gift of salvation and how it was made possible. We must never apologize. We can never possibly overtell the gospel because it is the greatest gift that man has ever received. It is the most awesome work that God has ever done. And you may notice that Christians have a tendency to use a monument or a memorial to remember that by. There's a cross on the wall behind me. Almost every Christian organization, parachurch organization, church, has a cross or multiple crosses on display prominently in their building. Christians even wear the cross. I suspect there are ladies here today who have a cross necklace on. Why do we do that? Because it's a visual reminder of God's love for us. It's a visual reminder, a monument, in other words, that causes us to remember God's love. Max Lucado put it like this in his book called His Name is Jesus. Lucado writes this. He said, "Can you turn any direction without seeing a cross? Perched atop a chapel, carved into a graveyard headstone, engraved in a ring, suspended on a chain, the cross is the universal symbol of Christianity. An odd choice, though, don't you think? Strange that a tool of torture would come to embody a movement of hope. The symbols of other faiths are more upbeat. The six-pointed star of David, the crescent moon of Islam, a lotus blossom for Buddhism. But a cross for Christianity? An instrument of execution? Would you wear a tiny electric chair around your neck? Suspend a gold-plated hangman's noose from the wall? Would you print a picture of a firing squad on your business card? And yet we do it with the cross. Why is the cross the symbol of our faith?" he asks. To find the answer, look no farther than the cross itself. Its design could not be simpler. One beam horizontal, the other vertical. One reaches out, like God's love. The other reaches up, as does God's holiness. One represents the width of his love. The other reflects the height of his holiness. The cross is the intersection. The cross is where God forgave his children without lowering his standards. How could he do this? In a sentence, God put our sin on his son and punished it there. So the cross is a monument. Maybe you haven't thought of it that way before, but it is. It is a symbol intentionally designed to remind us of God's love and of the gift of salvation that was made possible. We do it to remember his gift. Communion, or the Lord's Supper, is another monument or memorial. Next Sunday, we will partake of communion. And we do it because Jesus told us to. Jesus said, do this. But what did he say? What is the rest of that? Do this in remembrance of me. We partake of communion specifically to recall Christ's death, his sacrifice, and the new covenant that he brought through his death and resurrection. These are very familiar monuments and memorials in the Christian faith. The cross, communion. But I dare say that everyone who is a child of God should have other monuments in their life. Other reminders of God's love, of God's goodness, of God's faithfulness. If you were here on Easter Sunday, you may recall that at the end of that message, I asked everyone to stand who had ever experienced something in their life that could not be explained through any means other than God did it. And you may recall this room was filled with hundreds of people on their feet. And that was a wonderful moment because it was a visual reminder for all of us of the fact that we do experience God in our lives. But more wonderful than that to me was later that day, throughout that day, during fellowship time after the service, during Sunday school, during dinner, and even that evening, I heard lots of conversations that day of people saying, "What's your story? What did God do for you? What were you thinking of in that moment?" That should not be restricted to a one-day event. We should regularly be telling other people about God's goodness and his faithfulness and the things that he has done in our lives. We need to do that both because it is a testimony and it is an encouragement to others. But it's also a reminder for us. Because as I said before, the human mind is far too prone to forget the miraculous and wonderful works of God. In fact, I'm convinced that one of the greatest reasons why we are so prone to forget the wonderful works of God is that we, in our fallenness, and particularly as a result of the culture in which we live, not only are we prone to forget the awesome works of God, I think we are equally prone to have the attitude toward God of, what have you done for me lately? See, I'm in a really difficult time right now, God, and so I'm not feeling it. Yeah, that's true. You did that thing way back there. I know I'm going to be in heaven someday. That's great. But right now, my life stinks. We would be lying if any of us said we've never had that thought or that approach toward God. But it's kind of inexcusable. See, life is tough at times, and God told us it would be. There's going to be days where we really do wonder, why in the world is this happening to me? There's going to be days where we wonder, kind of like Habakkuk does at the beginning of his book. It's like, God, do you have any idea what's going on right now? I mean, how long, God, is this going to go on before you do something about it? But when we find ourselves going through a time of difficulty or a trial, the best thing we could do is often the last thing we do. The best thing we could do is remind ourselves of God's goodness and His faithfulness and the wonderful things that He has done for us and even just throughout history. Psalm 107 begins like this: give thanks to the Lord, for He is good most of the time. Oh, yours doesn't say that? No, it doesn't say that. It says, oh, give thanks to the Lord, for He is good. His steadfast love endures forever. Forever. Let them thank the Lord, for His steadfast love occurs repeatedly throughout Psalm 107. And by the way, if you read Psalm 107 in its entirety, which we're not going to do right now, but the psalmist goes through and talks about these difficulties that are being faced and the challenges of life, and then every time it ends with, let them thank the Lord for His steadfast love. Let's give you one example. Verse 10 says, some sat in darkness in the shadow of death, prisoners in affliction and in irons. But then it says they had rebelled against the words of God and spurned the counsel of the Most High, so He bowed their hearts down with hard labor. Sometimes the difficulty that we face is really a result of our own choices. It's because God is trying to get our attention and tell us that we need to come back to Him. But there are other times when we face difficulties in life precisely because we're doing what God told us to do. And He tells us that that's going to happen as well. Psalm 136, again, we see a great reminder. Psalm 136 in verse 1 begins, give thanks to the Lord, for He is good. His steadfast love endures forever. In this psalm, Psalm 136, it goes through these 26 verses that appear in Psalm 136. And every passage here in this one ends, His steadfast love endures forever. His steadfast love endures forever. His steadfast love endures forever. Psalm 145, another great psalm to remind us of the goodness of God. Verse 3 says, great is the Lord and greatly to be praised. His greatness is unsearchable. And see, I think we know this intellectually. I think if you are a child of God, you know in your mind, you have it filed away in there, God is awesome, God is good, God is holy, God is righteous, God is love. We know that, but we're prone to forget it. We're prone to ignore it. We're prone to let it be covered up by the difficulties of life so that those difficulties take precedence in our mind, take precedence in our attitude, take precedence in our approach to God. And see, another thing, if you're at all like me, you're prone to read the Old Testament accounts of the Israelites and think, man, they were dumb. How could they be so dense? Because we read through the Old Testament passages, particularly in the early part and in the Exodus, and we see all these awesome things that God did. And then we get a few verses later and we see the Israelites saying something like, we should have stayed in Egypt. It was so much better there. And you're like, hello, do you remember last chapter? But how often do we do that? How often do we go through life and we think, it would have been so much better if I was still doing that, or if I still lived there, or if I still had that job, or if my income was still this much. If. And no doubt if someone were privy to our thoughts and were reading the account of our lives several hundred years from now, they would be inclined to look and think, hello, do you remember last chapter? Do you remember what God did for you? Do you remember what he brought you out of? Do you remember that crisis you survived, that health scare that you came through, that bill that got paid and you don't know how? And see, that's the third thing that we need to take this morning. Not only did God do an awesome thing, and not only did he want the Israelite people to remember, but just like he wanted the Israelites to remember, he wanted them to tell the next generation, and he wants us to do the same thing. See, in Psalm 145, I just read to you verse 3 a moment ago. It says, great is the Lord and greatly to be praised. His greatness is unsearchable. Then it says, verse 4, one generation shall commend your works to another and shall declare your mighty acts. So this morning, I would urge you to find a monument or a memorial that will remind you of who God is and what God has done in your life, so that when you see it or when someone else sees it, it will open a door for you to say, let me tell you about God. Let me tell you what God did. Let me tell you how God worked in my life. These monuments will be reminders for you, but they will open doors of opportunity that may not otherwise open. They may prompt your children to ask a question. What's up with that? Why do you do this? What does this thing mean? It might be a date on the calendar. It might be a plaque on the wall. It doesn't even have to be tangible or visible. It's more effective, I think, if it is. But somehow, some way, we need to institute in our lives regular reminders of the goodness of God so that we are regularly faced with the need to remember what God has done for us. I give you a very simple example. This lapel pin that I've got right here. I know you've probably all seen it because I've had more people tell me at the door, you wouldn't believe how the light reflects off that pin on your coat. Well, that way you're not blinded by the light reflecting off my head. I wear this pin every time I have a suit coat on. And I have for years. I don't know how many of them I've gone through. I've lost a number over the years. And I've replaced it. But I can't tell you how many people over the years have said, what's up with the feet? And then I can say, these feet are the exact size of the feet of a baby 9 weeks after conception. And then all of a sudden, the sanctity of life is in the conversation. All of a sudden, someone who would have never considered even remotely getting close to the issue of abortion finds himself face to face with the fact that it's now unavoidable because they asked. But not only does it open doors for me to say something when somebody asks, It's a reminder to me every time I wear a different coat and I move this pin to the other, that there are children who are killed every day. And there are people working hard every day to make sure that another child isn't killed. And it reminds me to pray for them. It reminds me of my responsibility to defend the sanctity of life. So you may find something like a lapel pin. It may be a piece of jewelry. Like I said, it could be almost anything. There's certainly not chapter and verse that I could show you in the Bible that says, you must put one of these in your house. Not there. Do not leave here thinking, well, I got to go get me an icon now. Not what I'm saying, okay? I am saying, however, that we are without excuse when it comes to our neglect of regularly remembering and proclaiming the goodness of God. Matthew Henry said it like this in his commentary on Joshua 4, which we read. He said, "The works of the Lord are so worthy of remembrance, and the heart of man is so prone to forget them, that various methods are needful to refresh our memories for the glory of God, for our advantage, and that of our children." So may each of us find some way to create a memorial or a monument that will prompt us to remember and to proclaim the goodness of God. Father, we thank you for who you are. We thank you that you are an awesome God, a loving God, and that your love endures forever. We thank you that you are in control of everything that takes place. Nothing happens without your awareness. Nothing happens without your consent. Sometimes things happen that we really don't like. And that's okay. We could find psalms that are examples of that too, of the psalmist who poured out their lament over the difficulty that they were in. So I trust, Lord, that nothing I've said this morning will cause anyone to think that we should always take a happy-go-lucky approach to life, that we should go through life always smiling and telling everyone everything's great, because we will face difficulties. There will be difficult times and pain and hardship. But even when that happens, I pray, Lord, that we will not forget that you are good. And that whatever happens, even when it is painful and difficult, you're working through it for our good to accomplish your purposes and so that you will be glorified. Sometimes I suspect the monuments we could build or create may be to some of those painful times in our lives, or we've come through it refined, with rough edges smoothed off. We've grown closer to you. And sometimes our monuments will be to happy occasions, wonderful things that you've done. Whatever they are, Lord, my hope and my prayer today for myself and for all of us here is that we will not forget your goodness. That we will not be hesitant to proclaim your goodness, your faithfulness, your love to our children, to our neighbors, our coworkers, even sometimes to complete strangers, because you are good. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.